Hello and welcome. It's episode 46 of the NoCoMoto podcast. I'm your host, MotoG Pete, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yep.
Cool, cool. So, let's talk bikes. Actually, before we talk bikes, I've got a little bit of a mission for all of our listeners. Okay, so here's the deal. When you Google, not Google, when you search iTunes for motorcycle podcasts, like result number 4 or something is consistently the Pace. Now, nothing against the Pace. I used to listen to the Pace all the time. I think it was probably the first motorcycle podcast I listened to regularly. And the Pace got me hooked on to Cleveland Moto and Motorcycles and Misfits and all this other stuff. Great, great show. But they haven't put out an episode for like 2 years. And they're still like result number 4. Okay? And this is iTunes' fault completely, right? Because when you search for a motorcycle podcast, it pops up first. So people continue to listen to it more than other shows that are putting out new content, right? And it's sort of, you know, up there just because it's up there, right?
Yeah, it's like a feedback loop happening.
Exactly. And there's plenty of other shows where this is happening as well. But the Pace is the most obvious example of this. And so I want to kind of start a little bit of a campaign called, that I'm calling Dethrone the Pace. All right. Again, nothing against the show. I mean, James may have had like one of the best podcasting voices in the motorcycle podcasting realm. The show was fine. The show was great. Whatever. But enough's enough, right? Now, we're steadily growing, and that's fine. But, you know, I feel like we might pop up a little sooner if it wasn't for this dynamic that's happening. And we might already even have a larger listenership or whatever, okay? And so this isn't just for our benefit. This is kind of for the benefit of all of the smaller shows, right? So if you have listened to more than one episode of this show and you enjoy it in any way whatsoever, I implore you to leave a review or just hit, you know, the stars on it, whatever. You don't even have to write anything. You can do it as you're listening to the show, right? This is 10 seconds and this will make a huge impact. And I want every single one of our listeners to leave a rating and or review. That is what I'm requiring of you as a listener. Every week we spend a shit ton of time putting this together and we are asking you for zero money. We don't want any money from you at all. We just want some feedback because we've kind of determined the only way this is going to happen, this Dethrone the Pace, is we have to use all of our resources. So iTunes cares about how much feedback listeners give a show, and that figures into the algorithm and how you pop up in places, right? And it's a mixture of like total number of listens and other things, right? So I don't just want you to leave a review for us because you probably listen to other shows as well. Leave reviews for those other shows. And let's see if we can make, you know, the top 10 motorcycle shows, motorcycle podcasts, the most relevant top 10 motorcycle shows. Because there's some weird stuff in there that, you know, is just fine, but maybe doesn't still need to be in the top 10, right?
There's a lot of great content on a lot of the discontinued shows, but it's not current anymore. I mean, I'm sure there's some great episodes to go back and listen to. Given how current a medium podcasting is, people who are releasing regularly are going to be more relevant just because of that. But yeah, the iTunes system doesn't reflect that.
Right. So help us out. I mean, really, seriously, if every one of our listeners leaves a review, we will take a huge bump in the standings, and that'll factor in, and our audience will grow as a result. But you know, there's a lot of really small shows doing great stuff. So, you know, search out those, listen to them. If you enjoy them, leave a review. You know, it's just a sad fact that iTunes works in an unfair, stupid way. And we just need to rise above. So really, come on, help us out. We put in a huge amount of work into this, and we are simply asking for 10 seconds of your time, right? You don't even have to put your real name in there, right? So we're not even asking for your credibility. We are asking for 10 seconds of lightly touching a plastic screen. That's it. And the review doesn't have to be complicated. Tell us what you had for lunch. It doesn't matter what you write. It really doesn't. Just mention what kind of bike you have. And if you're stuck for like, well, what do I write? Just say, you know, hey, love the show. I write a whatever. That's it. That's, you know, or I do love it when people just leave total insane reviews that make zero sense too. So that you will tickle me if you just leave something weird. But seriously, just everybody without fail, right? There, you can't tell me while you're listening to this, there's not 10 seconds where you can just pull out your phone. You don't have to go to a different menu. Just scroll down there. There's a little spot where it says leave a review. You click on that. You hit 5 stars or 1 star, whatever, and type something in real quick. Done. 10 seconds will have no impact in your life whatsoever. Except that, well, maybe Motorcycle Podcast, the ones that are, you know, putting out content a little more regularly, will get a little more traction. And the overall motorcycle podcasting world might get a little bit better as a result. That's your part that you can play. So, okay, having said that, something we were going to mention at the beginning of last episode, but we forgot to edit in. Big announcement. We are going to be doing a Christmas episode for you. Like every podcast in the world and TV show and whatever takes off for Christmas. We're not like that. Because you're going to leave a review for us, we are going the extra mile and we are doing a Christmas episode. And here's why you need to know about it now. Because we're going to be doing an in-depth, hilarious, thoughtful, maybe, review of the classic film Torque. This is the best worst motorcycle movie ever made. It's absolutely insane. And we want you to come along on this ride for us. We might do it in real time with the movie, probably just to provide some reference. Maybe you might be able to watch the movie and listen along. Or it might just be for the device of just limiting how long it's going to be, because we could talk for like 6 hours about Torque. In fact, I think we have off mic talked about Torque for like 6 hours straight.
It's a very real possibility.
So we're giving you a couple weeks here to go on Amazon or whatever. Where did we find it?
Amazon.
I think you can watch it on Netflix movies as well. It's like $3.
He means YouTube.
And trust me, it's worth your time. If you know anything about motorcycles, there are just like spit your coffee all over the keyboard moments throughout this movie. It really, really delivers scene after scene. It never takes a break from being crazy. So look forward to that. It's going to be weird when we drop it. Sometimes there's like some blackout periods on when you can drop it and when iTunes will accept things around that time of year. So we may even have to drop it like a little early or something. We'll figure that out. But it'll be labeled like Christmas episode Torque Review. When everyone else is just left you high and dry, we got you. You know, it's like 7 o'clock on Christmas Day. You've had it up to here with your family. You just need to retreat to the garage and have some alone time. Like, you know, the kids are all playing with their toys. You know, you're not interested. There's no football on or whatever. Like this will be your little oasis. And our thank you for everybody leaving a rating and review. So now that we've got all that out of the way, we've got a very brief email to do here.
All right. So this is, from Brian.
Yeah, Brian. Was it episode 32 Brian guested with us?
35.
35. I was close. Okay. So Brian writes in again with a little bit of an interesting thing here.
So Brian is, asks us, what if I get an MT-09 to hoon around town and put an Akrapovic exhaust on that bitch with no DB killer? Good purchase, or am I an old loser? So apparently you can get a 2018 for pretty cheap.
Right. So my question is, if you're looking for a second bike that doesn't have to be practical, what is that perfect bike? Because he's already got a big sports tour, as it was described at length in that episode.
He's got the 1200 RS?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is a great bike, and you know, was best bike in the world that week, and that was a lot of fun to talk about. So now he just needs a second fuck-around bike. And the MT-09's a good choice, but is it the best choice? If I was picking, like, if I had an already fun but sensible bike, right, like that RS or like your Norge, what would be the stupid second bike just to hoon around town? I'm not taking road trips. I don't care about the tank size. I don't care about the comfort. It just has to be tons of fun.
So my thoughts on this are, if you're going to have two bikes, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have two bikes that are somewhat similar.
Right.
Now, obviously this is more of a street fighter compared to his, which is more sport tourer. But those are kind of close together categories. And it's also a fairly large bike with a buttload of torque and horsepower. But I feel like the MT-09 around town, you're never going to get it going all that fast. You're not going to get high up in the rev range.
Right.
And it's also just a little too similar to the 1200 RS in terms of size and torque and horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you need to be a little bit more of a hooligan here.
Yeah.
Now, originally, Brian, you had a G310?
Yeah, G310R.
Which was basically the BMW equivalent of like the R3.
Right.
Which, yeah, obviously, you know, doesn't have a lot of power, and you know, it's kind of terrifying to take on the highway, and it's not really up to what you wanted. But there is a very nice middle ground of lightweight bikes with tons of horsepower. And I think what you want to capture, especially if you're always if you know, if this bike is rarely going to do more than 55 miles an hour, then maybe go with something lighter that kind of feels and handles, you know, something you can throw around like that G310R, but has a bit more horsepower and has a bit more of a hooligan spirit in it, rather than this kind of reserved beginner bike feel.
So what kind of bikes do you have in mind?
So I kind of jumped around a little bit, you know, thinking maybe just a CBR 300R, or not 300R, 500R,
okay,
might be a good pick. Or maybe even like a CB500X might be a good pick. But then the one that I'm now sold on is Brian needs to get a DRZ 400 SM.
That's exactly where I'm at. That is the first thing that popped into my mind. So here you go, Brian. This is perfect for you. I don't think they're that expensive. What are they new? Like $8,000, somewhere around there?
Well, let's pull it up real quick.
I think it's going to be fairly comparable in price to a 2018 MT-09. But here's what this is bringing into your life.
$7,300.
$7,300. Perfect. So yeah, we're definitely in that same range of price. So this is a Supermoto. This is a Supermoto out of the box. And besides the KTM one, it's one of only two that you can buy on the market right now, right?
Pretty much. I mean, everybody else makes their own, but then you also have to drop like $1,800 on rims and another set of tires and custom spacers and all sorts of junk.
Exactly. And it can be a pain in the ass. You can do it wrong and whatever. So this is just set up. So this is the Suzuki RM 400, right? Just with sport tires, wheels, brakes, right?
Well, it's just the DRZ 400 with
right
with that, yeah.
Exactly. So there's nothing to worry about. You just buy it, and it's the way you want it, right? So what this will bring into your life is a very different kind of engine. It's a 400 single. It makes enough power to for short highway stints to not be totally terrifying. Is it going to be great on the highway? No. But if you're just kind of doing highway within Nashville, I think it's going to be just fine. Just short stints. But also, it's a supermoto, so it can do some light trail sort of stuff as well, there's plenty of places to do things like that around Nashville. You don't have to go very far to do a little bit of light sort of off-roady supermoto type stuff. But because it's got the street wheels on it, it's way better than just riding a dirt bike street legal around town. And here's the biggest thing, because you said something to hoon around town. I'm not aware of an easier bike to wheelie than this bike. It takes no skill at all, right? I mean, yeah, there are bikes that come up a little easier and whatever, but you have to kind of like know. Like with this, you just pull the throttle hard, front wheel comes up. Like this will bring wheelies into your life, Brian, like in like a cheater way almost. It's fantastic. Ask anyone that can wheelie really badass. They learn how to do it on a dirt bike. And here's another thing too. You're talking about hooning this bike around. It's a dirt bike. Like, what is there on this that's going to break that isn't easily replaceable? The plastics on dirt bikes are not near what it costs on a sport bike or something else. I mean, the bike's already designed to be crashed. That's the whole point of dirt bikes, right? So, well, not the whole point, but that's a big part. So it's cheap and affordable. It's going to hold value. Dirt bikes hold value really well. It's got a completely different kind of riding experience. And, you know, I wouldn't worry about this whole thing of being an old loser, right? Like you have a helmet, you have gear. That's, yeah, it's like what Bruce said. What Bruce from This Motorcycle Life said, like one of the greatest things that's ever been said about motorcycles, you know, if you're over 40 or whatever, someone asked him, well, why are you getting into this? And he said, well, how much money would you pay to be 21 again? Right? Like,
yeah.
It was a genius statement on Bruce's part that applies here. Like you can get a supermoto, Brian, and just put your helmet and jacket on and rip wheelies around Nashville and everyone's going to think you're 19 and whatever. And it doesn't matter. Like it doesn't matter. I don't think there's such a thing as an old loser on a bike. If you're riding the way you want to ride, I don't think age really comes into play.
So some other factors about this bike that I think will be really good for you is it is possibly the biggest contrast you can possibly get to the bike you have now.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be super minimalistic on the features and the dash. It's going to be super light. It's going to feel more like that 310R in terms of weight and handling. It's going to be really fun to just whip around at low speeds. And the bike in total is just kind of minimalist. And in a way that it's going to be so much more casual rather than like getting into a fighter cockpit. It's
right.
It's now just kind of this little thing. It's almost closer to a bicycle than it is to your 1200 RS, but you're going to get that torque and you'll just do silly little things that you wouldn't do on the RS.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's your best choice for a hooning around sort of thing. Although I will end all this with saying, like, the MT-09 is still a good choice. That's a great bike, and you can't really go wrong with that either. I would not make fun of you for having that as well. I just if it were us, we'd go with the 400 SM for sure.
Yeah, I think it's more of a it's kind of like owning a Porsche 911 and a Porsche Cayman at the same time. It's like, but why?
Yeah.
That's my only position on this. I mean, because they will have their own quirks and their own characteristics, but I kind of feel like with the MT09, it's not going to go anywhere that the RS couldn't, and it's not going to do any job that the RS couldn't. And I think what you'll, and vice versa. So I think if you end up getting an MT09, what you'll find is you'll probably sell one of those bikes in the next year. Because you'll just be riding one the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there we go. Yeah, I think that's all I've got on that one. But
I guess we actually have just presumed that this is going to be a second bike. And maybe he's not. Maybe he's moving on. He wants to move on to another bike.
I don't know. Brian seems so into it. I don't know. I see him as a two bike kind of guy now. I think he's ready to go there, which is really quick. But why not? I support having multiple bikes. I mean, there's a certain point where you have too many bikes, and you can't really give them all the attention that they need. But two is the perfect number of motorcycles to own. You know, if one breaks or fucks up, you fall out of love with, you get rid of it, you still got this other one to ride. There's nothing wrong with, you know. I don't know what the used market is on the 400 SM, but you can probably pick up a pretty decent one around 5 to 6 and probably sell it after a year for exactly what you paid for it. I'm going to guess that's probably very realistic in the Nashville area as far as prices and all that sort of stuff. And I think all the 400 SMs are identical. Like, it doesn't matter what year you get. They're all the same bike. There's no advantage over having the new one or a certain year over others. I think they're all a 4-speed transmission, right? For some reason,
No, they're all 5-speed.
They are 5? Oh, for some reason, I thought the Suzuki's were 4, but okay, it doesn't
You've been
matter.
Looking at Royal Enfields for too long.
Right. So, okay. Yeah, there you go, Brian. That after meditating on this for many days, this is where we've arrived. But, you know, do what you're going to do, you know, and let us know what you buy for certain. We really want to know. I don't know, maybe we should just have you on and, like, just you could surprise us with what you bought, right? We could do that. Okay, so now we're going to move on to best worst bike in the world this week. All right, let me stretch and remember because I don't have anything written down right now. Our usual disclaimer. Every week, we pick the best and the worst bike in the world this week, always rotating back and forth who is best and worst. We do not know what the other person has chosen. If you get your feelings hurt by our choices, well, that's kind of too bad. Like Liza said, there's no crying in motorcycles, but if you do have an interesting take or we get some facts horribly wrong, do write in and let us know. We still haven't gotten any corrections or omissions emails. I know we're not that good. We've definitely missed a bunch of shit, but I guess people are, you know, going like, oh, I could see how they got that backwards. But anyway, send us corrections if you want. If you have an interesting take, do it. Otherwise, if you're just whining, shut up. So, with that, Swiggy, you have the worst bike in the world this week, right?
Yep.
All right. You ready to reveal it?
Yep.
Okay. Let's drum roll. And the worst bike in the world this week is?
The 1997 Moto Guzzi Centauro.
How do you keep finding these bikes I've never fucking heard of? Oh my God. Okay. I just always love to give my first initial reaction to seeing the picture of these. So this appears to be something that I would hate, but I think I could own for like a summer, ironically. But
that's about how, well, you probably only get a couple weeks of riding in.
Dive in and okay. Tell me.
So overall, there isn't, I mean, this has more than usual the kind of Italian electrical gremlins of the time and some weird steering issues. But what this bike really is a bike nobody asked for, a bike nobody got, and a bike that even from its initial impressions still did not age well.
Yeah, it did not age well. So what year is this?
This is a 97.
97. So the back half looks like a Hayabusa. The front kind of looks, with that little bikini fairing, a little bit like the V1200 Sport that I love. But then in the tank, that kind of flows connected with the bodywork all the way through to the back. There's something going on that's somewhere in between like a Kawasaki Vulcan and a Buell. And none of it makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, that's about right. So this is, you know, kind of a good time for Italian motorcycle manufacturers. Lots of things were looking good at the time. I believe this was just pre Piaggio acquisition, okay, or maybe just after. But they were shifting up a bunch of stuff. They were trying new shit out, and someone got the bright idea to say, hey, most big cruisers are V-twins. We make V-twins. Let's make a cruiser.
Right. So this is sort of Moto Guzzi's thing at being a cruiser before they kind of re-envisioned the whole California Eldorado line.
Right. And yeah, this is, it kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah.
So this is, yeah, so they put, it's also a huge bummer when you hear about it, because it's the V10 Centauro.
Right.
Which could make you think, oh, is this some crazy 10-cylinder V-twin or V motor? It's like, no, it's just the V10, because every Guzzi is called the V. But on top of that, I mean, it had some pretty respectable, you know, on the spec sheet, it looked pretty good. It is kind of one of the early 8-valve motors.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The bike weighs just under 450 pounds, which really? For a 1-liter Guzzi is pretty damn good.
Okay. This is all starting to make sense again. Where does this go wrong again?
So, well, the main thing is that the suspension is kind of terrible. The rear is super stiff, and then the front is super loose, and apparently it doesn't handle very well. If you see one of these in person, it's so much worse than this picture lets on.
Oh, yeah?
It doesn't really come together all that well. Let me find some better ones. Like, if you look at the, so, like, here's a picture over the dash.
Oh, good God.
And when you kind of just look at it in profile and you see how the motor sticks out and the real shape of the tank, this is not like cartoonish kids fantasy Centaur. This is like a what was that old like 80s movie called?
80s movie with a Centaur?
With it was something really weird. It was named after the villain. It was like
Krull?
It might have been Krull. With the Cyclopses.
Yeah, that's Krull.
Yeah, Krull. This is like the Krull Centaur.
Yeah. So the fuel cap is like looks like some sort of like cancerous growth coming out of the top of the bike in a way that like you've seen it do on other cruisers, and obviously that was supposed to be a nod towards the cruiser styling, but that doesn't come across correctly in this sort of sport tourer cruiser sort of thing that they're trying to do here.
Well, they've tried to combine it with this two-tone tanks design and with knee cutouts.
Well, it's weird because the side covers, the knee cutouts, and part of the bodywork leading all the way up to the front of the tank are all one piece on each side of the bike. So it looks like you need to remove about 2 feet of bodywork to get to your carburetors, which
is fuel injected.
Okay, well, whatever. To get to components of the engine, you need to remove quite a lot of stuff that really seems completely unnecessary. I can't state enough how much the back of this looks like a Hayabusa. Why? The whole front of the bike is... Yeah, the tank just sort of like ends up being like pointy at the top, where it looks from a side profile, they're trying to make it really big and fat and bulbous and cruisery. And it's almost they thought like, okay, let's write down all the things that Americans want in a cruiser style of bike and then put them together in a no compromise way.
I feel like somebody came up with the idea of what they wanted to do with this bike.
Uh-huh.
And how they wanted it to be. And then they only communicated to engineers over the phone.
Right.
And this is the result of that conversation.
Like, it must have been like, okay, we need a big comfy seat. And this looks like a really big, wide, comfy seat. And they're like, okay, like big old fat Americans are going to get on this. So it looks like they've added a bit of padding to the front of the tank to just sort of like cushion, like, you know, fat dudes like panises resting over the front of the tank. And then there's a little like stop on the back of the seat. So it's like, you know, they're going to want a little bit of a backrest. So it's got to have that. But they want it to be sporty. So they basically gave it a Hayabusa tail. And they're like, but it's got to be shiny and colorful. So they put this two-tone thing in. And they're like, but it's got to have, you know, taller cruiser handlebars. So they've put this ridiculous riser thing on the front with these almost straight bars going across it that are displeasing. And they're like, it's got to have gauges. But they've put these very – it does have dial gauges and lights and things, but it's in this very Italian way. It's clearly just ripped out of a sport bike somewhere else and then just put on here. That they thought, okay, it's going to need – oh, my gosh. It's
so
– yeah, it doesn't come together at all. It's way better in the one color because that somehow hides the horrible shape of it.
So I know they're usually not that accurate, but if we go with Nada guides, the MSRP for this bike in 1997 was $13,000. What do you think the retail average is today?
Oh, was this a U.S. only bike?
No.
Okay. But we're talking U.S. prices for one today.
Yeah.
In perfect condition, I don't see even Nada rating this at more than
$2,200. $1,340.
Whoa!
There are Nighthawks worth more than that on Craigslist.
80s Nighthawks. Oh my gosh.
This bike resonates with nobody.
This is anti-collectible.
Yeah. There aren't people who own these, and there aren't people that are collecting these. There are people that are stuck with these.
Yeah, buying one of these at $1,300, that would be like spending $1,300 on Beanie Babies, just hoping that market comes back, right? Like not buying Beanie Babies back in the day, buying someone's old collection of Beanie Babies, just going like, nope, I'm still waiting for this to float back up. Like I'm going for like the bottom dollar stock. Like I am buying Apple stock in 1992, like when it's real low, hoping it comes back up, right? You know, except the Apple thing never happens, right?
Pretty much.
$1,300 for it. Okay. Well, Well, that does change things a little bit, actually. So a good one is $1,300, right?
That's average.
Average?
Okay. I'm sure like a good one's like $2,000 to $3,000.
So we have to bring that into play now. You say that this has more than average reliability problems. So, and you said that's electrical, because I can't believe that Guzzi made a complete dog shit motor. It might be disappointing in ways or something.
No, but the motor's actually very good. It's 95 horsepower and 97 out of a 1 liter twin.
Yeah, and I bet it's got buttloads of torque and it kind of gets up and goes enough. Yeah.
Yeah, the motor's not the problem at all.
The problem is you're not going to buy one of these with a manual. And I'm sure the wiring diagram that you might find that's all labeled completely in Italian makes no sense. And knowing Guzzi, like, it probably varied slightly year to year as well. And you're not going to find a shop that's going to be able to fix it for you, like, ever. Hence why it's so cheap. And then everyone's going to think you're fucking weird writing this. We were talking about old bikes the last few episodes or retro bikes where you sort of get a little bit of built-in credibility, or you perceive that you do, right? And you can just go buy a Harley and kind of instantly be in the Harley club. And there's plenty of sport bikes you can buy and instantly be in the Harley club. And I'm hard pressed to think of bikes that don't get you into some sort of club. Even a Honda Metropolitan gets you into some sort of club, right? I don't know that this gets you a kinship with anybody right off the bat. Like, there's no image, lifestyle, or anything that comes along with this.
I mean, it's got the Moto Guzzi badge, but that's about it.
But the Moto Guzzi badge does not carry a lot of currency in the United States.
That's true.
This is less than 1% of riders. And if we figure that riders are only 3% of the population, so 1% of 3%, less than.
It's actually like 0.3% of the market.
Right. So you have to meet, I don't know, how many thousands of people would you have to meet before you found someone that was just familiar with Moto Guzzi? And then how many of those Moto Guzzi followers know about this bike, right? If you buy this bike, it's like you only potentially have one friend in the entire world and you don't know where they are, right? This is like the Mormons or someone believes that, like, predestined for, like, you know, one person or something like that. But you were given no clues as to where, you know, your partner out there is, right? This is that sort of like, there's only one person out there for me sort of thinking. This comes with no club, no credibility, no nothing. All you're going to have is, you cannot have a, okay. So a lot of people buy bikes because they like the weird questions about these odd bikes, right? We always say Goldwing trike guy or whatever, right? Loves having the conversation about it. Because that conversation is ultimately very pleasing for them, because they get to tell you all these things about it. Well, there's nothing really that interesting about this bike. So
I think the kind of person who would choose to buy this bike today would be the kind of person who really wants to invite that conversation, but then people just kind of avoid eye contact and
exactly.
Walk away.
Exactly. There's no payoff because you're trying to tell someone about this bike, but there's never going to be that. Their eyes are never going to light up with interest at all. It's not particularly powerful. It doesn't look good. It's not particularly, you know, super rare or collectible. It's not known even by people who are fans of the brand. This is like trying to hang out. Like, let's say you do find a Moto Guzzi club, right? That's like trying to like drive up to like a Mopar like car show in a Dodge Omni. You're not speaking the same language, right?
It's also kind of like moving to a small town and looking for the Roxette fan club.
Oh, wow. Yeah. If you own one of these and you love riding it, more power to you. But this is, I love weird stuff. I love unusual stuff. This is a bridge too far for me. Now seeing how it actually looks from other angles, I couldn't do this. I couldn't go there. Not even for a summer, just ironically. This is, yeah. All right. Are we good on this?
I think so.
All right. So 97 Moto Guzzi V10 Centauro Sport. Worst bike in the world this week. Still better than a car. Okay. All right. Now we're moving on to best bike in the world this week. Are you ready? Strap yourselves in. And the best bike in the world this week is, I can't believe we haven't talked about this yet, the Britain V1000. So I picked this because if anyone's paying any attention, I like to kind of flow my best and worst bikes into the in the world this week into each other a little bit. So last week I picked a bit of a concept bike to some degree and what's wrong with that and why it being different is so stupid. Well, this is brilliant. If you don't know about the Britain, a lot of people just call it the Britain, but there were a couple other different bikes that John Britton made, but the V1000, this is the one. This is what everyone calls the Britain. And this is automotive art. This is cool technology. But more than anything else, it's this amazing story about this kind of guy, which is the kind of guy that just is the kind of guy that doesn't come along very often. So in like 89, something like that, John Britton started basically creating like an aero package for a friend of his racing, I think, a Ducati bike of some description. And he came up with this bike called, that they ended up calling like the Aero D. And there's the Aero D0 and the Aero D1 and whatever. And those are really just super rare one-off build things. And the Britain itself, the V1000, is very rare. So after, I'm going to backtrack and say a little bit more about John Britton himself. John Britton was an engineer. And he is one of those guys that apparently could just never stop. Like by age 7, he was building his own go-karts. At 17, apparently he pulled an old Indian Scout, like a 1940s Indian Scout, out of like a riverbed and restored it himself. And he wanted to be an engineer. He built his own house. And he always had this philosophy of doing really big, impressive things on a shoestring budget. And apparently he's one of these guys that just never stopped working, just relentlessly doing everything that he possibly could. And he was always obsessed with motorcycles. And so he got this idea that a lot of the bikes racing had this aerodynamic problem that they weren't taking advantage of. And he realized in certain parts of races, it didn't matter how much horsepower you had, there was an aero problem that was inescapable, and he saw a way around it. And so he had an idea to take advantage of high and low pressure areas created by airflow around the bike and force air into the engine that way and create more power in these problematic areas on the track. And in order to fully take advantage of all his ideas, he realized he had to build a motorcycle completely from scratch. And when I say like from scratch, I mean from scratch and with no computers. Like this thing is ridiculous. I mean, the only computer used was to help program the computer that they eventually put into it. And it's like the computer system they didn't make, but they did, and like the spark plugs they didn't make, and the spark plug leads they didn't make, and like the regulator rectifier they didn't make, and everything else John Britton and a few of his friends made by hand. They designed and cast their own engine.
What?
Yes. The Britton is powered by a 1 liter V-twin Britton engine.
Okay.
That they made the wheels. They made everything.
Are those carbon fiber wheels?
Yes. Everything on this is carbon fiber. Absolutely everything.
Ooh.
And it does not have a carbon fiber frame because it doesn't have a frame. Every piece of this bike just fits to the next piece. There is no frame holding the whole thing together.
So this is a bunch of parts bolted onto a motor.
Right. So, yeah, the suspension system, right? It's a double wishbone, kind of like a Goldwing. See, there's that shock down there below.
Oh.
There's another one up top as well, right? And this was all made by John and his team. Completely. The whole, all the body work, you know, he sat out there and did all the wiring and then made a mold and everything. He cast all this stuff, the crazy spaghetti looking tuned exhaust system. All of this was done out with pencil and paper by John Britton. Absolutely all of it. And you know how long it took him to do this?
How long?
1 year.
What?
Yeah. Whilst he was holding a full-time job, he did all of this working through the night, like apparently just not sleeping for a year. I mean, they'd done some work and they'd taken a bike to Daytona, but it failed. It broke down and whatever. So John, for this what eventually became like, you know, the final sort of version of the V1000, this was 1 year that they built this bike, just a team of a few dudes making every single part completely from scratch, like this version of it. And yeah, they were standing on a little bit of the shoulders of some of their own knowledge, but every single part of this, I mean, redesigned and made in 1 year. It's absolutely insane.
Now, is this just a steering damper bolted to the engine on one side and the front fork on the other?
Like, everything about this bike is weird and unusual. Every single piece of it is just bananas. Nothing's where you expect it to be. Nothing works the way you expect it to be. The aerodynamics are absolutely insane. But it's also, for something so kind of high tech and unusual, it's oddly beautiful as well. You would think something that's dictated so much by pure aerodynamic and just engineering principles wouldn't have a really great aesthetic to it, but this absolutely does.
I don't know. You kind of,
the blue and pink and the stars like livery on this is just beyond cool. I think
it is very cool. But I feel like this might be somewhat of an acquired taste.
This is kind of universally regarded as one of the greatest motorcycles of all time. Now, here's what's really crazy about this. So this was made in 1 year by a very, very small team of guys in John Britton's garage. I mean, parts of this, like the parts that they were casting were like heat treated in like his wife's pottery kiln, like crazy shit like that, or just being dumped into his swimming pool to cool down. Like this was done on almost no money. And here's the crazy thing. So after a year, they did very minimal testing with it. I mean, they got it dynoed, but they didn't really get it out and track test it. They took it straight to Daytona for the Battle of the Twins race and put it up against factory Ducatis. And at first, well, it was, well, it actually immediately it went to the front of the pack. And then one of the few parts that they didn't actually make broke. And it was an electrical piece. It wasn't anything mechanical. But even crazier than that, the day before, like during qualifying, they got in one really shitty qualifying lap. And then one of the cylinder liners, the sleeves, cracked. And it was causing the engine to overheat. And they did this like brazing thing to it. And apparently, like, they took this bike to Daytona and everybody was blown away by it. All these factory teams, everyone was just gushing over it. And when they had this problem with the engine, like, calls went out. Other teams were trying to help them, like people helping them through the night to get this bike up and running again. Because, and it's weird because there's a strange, similarity to Burt Monroe, you know, the world's fastest Indian. Like, it was just this unusual thing of these guys coming from New Zealand with this amazing bike and like no resources. And everyone was so in love with their effort, they kind of helped them along. And it, they were like just calling shops going like, look, we have this complete one-off motorcycle. There's a cylinder cracked, a sleeve cracked. Like, we need to get a new one made, like machined, like today. Yeah, and this is during Daytona Bike Week. Like, everyone's busy, right? And they tried and tried and tried. No one could. So they had to do this last-minute, like, weird fix, which had, like, a 1 in 100 chance of working. But it did. But ultimately, the regulator rectifier failed. And with, like, the minimum number of laps to go, they had to leave the race. But then it went, like, it created so much of a buzz. They took this thing all over the place and started winning races in Europe with it. And at one point, I think Joey Dunlop was going to ride it at the Isle of Man, but the test rider at Isle of Man crashed and died. So, again, the front suspension, the rear suspension, the aero, the engine itself, every single part of this prototype, every single part of this, you know, revolutionary and crazy, it did not make more overall horsepower than even the Ducatis. But apparently it kind of like did what a Ducati did power-wise even better. They compared it to more like riding a 500cc two-stroke Grand Prix bike than a four-stroke superbike.
Mm-hmm.
It just wheelied like crazy. I mean, this had like full-on electronics. It knew air temperatures and everything. It didn't have an IMU, but short of that, had everything electronics-wise a motorcycle could possibly have, in order to control the power and do all sorts of things.
What year was this?
So this bike is 1992. It's absolutely way ahead of its time. There's just nothing else was like it. This was the most technologically advanced motorcycle in 1992. Like, absolutely. And everyone worldwide was in love with it. Every motorcycle magazine was like, here we go. Here's the future. It's here. Like, oh my gosh, this guy in New Zealand just showed us all exactly what we're going to do. But here's the problem. This bike was just handmade, one off by John Britton. And they made like 10 of them. And they were all wonderful. And they were all like competitive race bikes. But the DNA of this was all in John Britton's head.
Yeah.
And no one else could really create this or keep improving it except for John Britton. Because he had this whole thing of first thoughts, first ideas. Nothing on this bike was derivative of any other motorcycle. He came up with his main points of how he wanted to make it, and then everything else was a follow through of that. There are no parts shared with anything else. And for it all to come together and to continue to be developed, it really required John Britton himself. And I think in like 94 or 95, he got cancer and died. And that's why it didn't go any further. But for this very brief moment, everybody worldwide in the motorcycle world was just stunned by this guy working in his shed after hours, right? Mm-hmm. This bike did some like speed record sort of stuff as well, like within New Zealand. Like I said, Isle of Man, I mean, it was all going places. And then he died, and it sadly kind of just had to die with him because John Britton himself was so important to the bike. And it's really, you know, because it wasn't the fastest bike in the world or anything. And, you know, it wouldn't have been faster necessarily than GP racers, but within certain kinds of racing, it was extremely competitive, and it was just made by some guy. Right.
Right.
And there used to be, it's weird because this is a bike that signaled, you know, the future in different technologies and new ideas, but it also signaled the end of an era where you didn't necessarily have to have a full factory effort to be successful in racing. If you were just enough of a mad genius, you could put something together like this and be hugely successful. So they only made 10 of them, and I think all 10 of them still exist. But in order to own – and these are in like, you know, like museums and everything, right?
Right.
Like I think only once in history have all 10 of them been assembled into one spot. And I think when that happened, they had like Guy Martin ride one, but he was kind of afraid to really fully ride it because – they're all kind of basically priceless.
Right. Yeah, this is the bike you put in a museum. This is
right.
The 0.001% of bikes that goes.
And by today, ride. You know, by now, like even bikes that are a little bit old, like maybe a Ducati 999 might beat this now or something. But in its day, like 1992, this was the top of the mountain in a lot of ways. And small little things from it have been borrowed and used over time. But, you know, if you were going to make this a production bike at the time, it would have been so unbelievably expensive. So that's why it didn't really make a lot of the things that have to do with this didn't make their way into consumer motorcycles because, I mean, there's no compromise in this for starters. So it's not a bike that a lot of people would be willing to live with. Right. You know, you think race bikes are really cool, but even a very common race bike is not really something you can live with day to day. And this was just totally that way. And yeah. So when you think about like, you know, well, if it was so brilliant, why isn't it still around? There are legitimate reasons, but it was legitimately badass and competitive with the fastest bikes in the world of its kind from the humblest of beginnings. So yeah, it's just one of the coolest stories in motorcycles ever.
Yeah. I think that about sums it up.
Yeah. Sorry to outdo you on the Fisher there a little bit, but yeah. And of course, on Netflix, there's an awesome like hour and a half documentary about all this that you should totally go watch if you haven't. But I'm sure plenty of people probably have. But it's it's like the coolest story ever. So check out the Britton. All right. Let's take a little bit of a break and then we'll come back. All right, and we're back. So now we're going to talk about something that, I don't know, some listeners might just immediately want to like just click off at this point, although don't, trust me. We're going to talk about important shit. So we're going to talk about racing and some racing history, but this is all America-centric, right? So motorcycle racing and the United States goes back a long way. And there was a time there were a ton of amazing American racers in MotoGP. So we want to talk about some of that because it seems that MotoGP right now, to a large extent, has this problem with American viewership because there's not a lot of riders to identify with. And you see a lot of riders popping up from like Thailand and Singapore, Malaysia, Japan. And they kind of call these passport rides. These are racers who are very good. I mean, everyone who's in MotoGP deserves to be there. But at a certain point, there are, you know, the competition's fierce to get there. And simply being a certain nationality will edge out a rider over an equivalent rider, let's say, because there's that much more viewership that's going to come with that racer being involved because of their nationality, right? So why aren't there any Americans? Well, because they don't feel like there's the American talent right now and the people that will follow them. And that's really, really sad because there's a long list, and we're going to go over some of the best here, of races that you should know about. And again, if you followed our advice and you have got the video pass for MotoGP, you can go back in time and watch a lot of these races and watch these Americans just dominating. Okay. So let's start with Freddie Spencer. I think that's a good place to go. So Freddie was racing in, it wasn't called MotoGP at the time, but was essentially racing in MotoGP in the mid 80s. So we're not going to go through like every race and everything like that, but we're just going to give you enough to sort of like maybe pique your interest and then go watch some of the stuff that these guys did. So I think it was 82 that Freddie Spencer got to MotoGP essentially. And he'd been racing dirt and everything, and he brought in a very different style of riding than really anyone had seen before. He was a dirt track champion, and that played into a lot of his style. And he raced in, you know, AMA stuff and British stuff before that. Gets his way. He's on the 500cc two-stroke bikes and just really kicks some ass. I think he won 3 championships in a row, like 78, 79, 80. Like, he was a big deal. I think he was the youngest MotoGP champ at one point.
Yeah, it was called the 500cc World Championship at the time. Right. And he won it at 21, and at that point was the youngest person to win it.
Right, and he was what a lot of people were doing at this time as well. He was racing in multiple classes at once. So I think he won Moto2 essentially and MotoGP in the same year, even. Freddie Spencer, big deal. From Louisiana, they called him Fast Freddie. You got to know about this guy. It's just fantastic. So from there, I think we should talk about, I think around the same time period is, after he left, we get Kevin Schwantz and Wayne Rainey. And there were other Americans involved too, but these are really like two big superstars. If you don't know about Kevin Schwantz and Wayne Rainey, you're living under a rock. These guys are absolute heroes. So they were both fierce rivals in AMA superbike racing. And just long time rivals. And they took that rivalry when they both went into MotoGP. Again, it wasn't called MotoGP, but we're just going to keep saying that because that's what you're going to know we're talking about. At the same time, they brought that and all that drama that they've been building for years, you know, passing championships back and forth between them and wins back and forth into MotoGP. And they both won MotoGP championships. They usually had about the same number of wins, but Wayne Rainey would often get those second and third place finishes more often and overall won these championships, even though they were always neck and neck for the amount of wins every year. And they had very different styles. I think Schwantz rode for Suzuki and Wayne Rainey for Yamaha. Yes. And again, very different styles, very different philosophies. Kevin Schwantz was sort of the bad boy. He was the one that was most likely to go off the rails and say something crazy. And his riding style was very Marquez, sort of on the edge. Whereas Rainey was a little more Lorenzo, smooth and fast and technical. But they were just neck and neck all the time, and Wayne would usually edge out in the points for the championship. And then tragically, the two were racing each other really hard, and Rainey had a crash and ended up paralyzed, and that, you know, ended his career. And Schwantz won the championship then and has since said, you know, if he could change history, you know, he would have preferred that, you know, Wayne did not end up paralyzed and won the championship and he came second. He said, you know, it wasn't worth it. But, you know, it wasn't his fault. They were racing. That's just something that, you know, people used to die and get hurt a lot more often in those days. That was just a reality of racing. So apparently they maintain a really good friendship these days, but they hated the shit out of each other back in the day. They were always trash talking. And when you go back and watch some classic races of them, which I have done, you can really see it in how they're going at each other. And this is right around the time that the 500cc bikes kind of almost got developed as much as they possibly could. They are really wild. They're still carbureted and everything, but they're just, they're as complicated as a carbureted bike could possibly be. The bikes are really something else, and it's worth watching any racing from this time for the 500cc bikes because, well, there's just high side crashes everywhere, which are spectacular, but the bikes are just barely controllable. The amount of skill these guys had was unreal. These are bikes that just didn't want to be ridden, essentially.
Well, yeah, because you've got these carbureted 500cc two-strokes that are tuned for the maximum amount of power, and the tires just aren't up for it.
No, nothing's up for it. I mean, it's the best technology around at the time, but just the weird narrow power bands, the gearing, it's just everything about the bike just makes it want to just fly off the track at any moment. It's what they were doing is extremely, extremely athletic and just on the edge in a way that modern racers just aren't even on the edge. The whole 500cc era is fantastic. A lot of people think that this is the greatest motorcycle racing ever was. The sort of late 80s to early 90s is when it sort of peaked in terms of the racing itself. I kind of disagree. I kind of think the early part of the four-stroke era, the MotoGP era, with Rossi is the best. But, yeah.
Well, there's a good argument to be made here that this is like the Max Q, like, intersection of raw power and lack of rider aids.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's something crazy. It's totally worth watching. Look into Wayne Rainey and Kevin Schwantz. And then from there, I want to let's talk about someone a little bit less known. So the gambit of American riders is really all over the place. So maybe let's jump to someone unusual like Ben Spies, because this is another one of those AMA jump to MotoGP stories, right? So Ben Spies had what year did he go into GP? Was that like 2008, 2009, somewhere around there? Am I off base?
So he did have a wild card appearance in 2008, and then he did a bunch of test riding for Rizla Suzuki.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the Ben Spies story, essentially, though, was a very, very talented rider that just never got matched up with the right team and the right bike. I kind of feel he just sort of like came into it in a time where if you weren't immediately going to a factory team, you weren't going anywhere. And he kind of fizzled out, but he came in with there was just so much excitement about this American racer that was going to turn everything upside down. And I think he raced alongside Rossi in early days and, I mean, not early days for Rossi, but, you know, when Rossi was at the top.
Yeah, so we had appearances from, like, 2009 to 2013.
There we go. And I want to mention Ben Spies because, and John Hopkins here as well, because it wasn't just like one or two American superstars at a time. The whole paddock was just sort of peppered with Americans all over the place. And as a result, American viewership was high compared to now, at least anyway, because Americans used to be in love with kind of all kinds of racing. And it was much more prevalent. I mean, think about how popular NASCAR was in the 80s and 90s. It was huge. It was like as big as the NFL is right now. NASCAR was gigantic. And
oh, you know, I'm an idiot. Mm-hmm. No, Spies replaced Rossi on the factory team.
When Rossi went to Ducati, yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, he did legit seasons, yes. But like I said, the team wasn't right for him and it just didn't work out. And then he quickly got pushed back. Didn't he go back to he went to World Superbike, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And again, like mixed results there, just never really lined up for him, but amazingly talented guy and all that. And then we get, you know, like I said, at the same time or about the same time you get like John Hopkins, right?
Right. So he did AMA. Up to 2009, but he did kind of do, he did a bunch of
wild cards.
Yeah, he did a bunch of wild cards. He did some wild cards in 2008 and 2009, and then he was riding with Yamaha from 2010 to 2012, and then he, I'm not sure what team he rode for, but he also rode the GP13 for a year.
Right. And so around this time, we get sort of John Hopkins coming into the picture. Just another little American hopeful. Got a couple podiums here and there. You know, did all right. But, you know, he rode for Suzuki before Suzuki kind of threw in the towel and then came back again in, what, 2015? That's when Suzuki came back, right? I think that's right. Anyway, he was a younger guy, you know, again, had some he'd ridden two-stroke 500s and then kind of like came into, you know, the four-stroke era, kind of bridged gaps there again. So let's go back to another like legend that everyone should absolutely know about, because again, around this time, we've got Nicky Hayden. You can't talk about Americans in MotoGP without talking about Nicky Hayden, the Kentucky kid. Again, success with racing in the United States jumps over to MotoGP. Nicky Hayden, as far as I know, is the only American to win the championship on a four-stroke bike.
Yes.
And it was a crazy season when he won as well. The points were tight. The championship was settled on the last race. And it was nuts. Was it the year before? Was it 2005 when Danny Pedrosa took out Hayden? Or was that during the 2006 season?
Oh, I can't remember. I'm terrible with these.
It's one of those two. This is about when I got into watching MotoGP hardcore. Like, people were talking about Nicky Hayden left and right. It was a name that people knew. It's hard to think about that, but people did know, people who weren't into motorcycles to some extent back in 2005, 2006 knew who he was. They were having him do exhibition laps at the Indy 500 and stuff like that. He was all over the place. He was, you know, he wasn't in like commercials and stuff, but you'd see him on posters and things around Indianapolis when it was racing, whatever. And he's just a good old boy. And, you know, he had the number 69 and he really like leaned into that as well. And Nicky with his crazy earrings and just sort of good old boy slash, I'm hanging out with the Euro guys trying to fit in, like, but always being super American, his red, white, and blue helmets. He just really brought a dose of the good old US of fucking A into the sport in a way that I don't think any other racer really did. And if you go watch MotoGP now, even in other countries, but especially in Austin. I mean, just the number of 69 flags, hats, t-shirts everywhere is unbelievable. There are people that to this day just fucking hate the shit out of Danny Pedrosa for taking out Nikki in a crucial race, and will never, Danny Pedrosa will never ever, like, Danny Pedrosa could cure cancer and never redeem himself in the eyes of a large part of the American racing audience for taking out Nikki. Like, and they were teammates at the time. Nikki racing one for Honda. So this is all, like, you know, before Marquez was part of the picture. And Nikki continued racing for quite a while, but he was it last year? Yeah, last year, tragically died. He'd gone to World Superbike. He was training. He was in Europe, wasn't he? He was training on his bicycle.
He was in Italy.
He got hit by a car on a pedal bicycle and was killed tragically. You know, Nikki was, he was one of those guys that even after the championship, and he never put together a great season, still had some wins here and there, and was one of those guys that you could just never completely count out on any given weekend, no matter what. Kind of like Rossi is now. Like, yeah, Rossi's kind of done as far as winning championships, but you can never really count him out.
Right.
You know, and Nikki brought that and kept a lot of people interested in racing for a long time because of that factor. So go back and watch anything with Nikki Hayden, because you just never know what's going to happen in those races. Really, really great stuff. So let's go back in time a little bit, because we haven't talked about Eddie Lawson. So Eddie Lawson is kind of one of the most successful, I think maybe the most successful American in MotoGP ever, right? How many championships did he win? Oh, four. Four he won. So that's from 84 to 89. And yeah, that's all you need to know about Eddie Lawson. He's sort of America's Rossi in a way. Was it Kawasaki did that Eddie Lawson tribute bike in like 2012, right?
Yeah.
At a time when people were like, who the fuck's Eddie Lawson? I mean, Eddie Lawson's a big fucking deal. You should know about this guy. He rode for Honda and another, I think he won for several different manufacturers. I could be wrong there.
Well, he's got three championships with Yamaha and one with Honda.
There we go. Yeah, I knew I wasn't talking completely out of my ass. All right. Anyone else on this, like, sort of essential to know list that you can think of? I think we covered a lot of the big ones that you really need to know. The point is there's also, like, a lot of others that just kind of pop up here and there and pepper out the lower classes as well. And so what the reason we're talking about this is, well, there's not really a passport ride for an American rider right now. The only American in MotoGP at all right now is Joe Roberts, who, weirdly enough, isn't he like English born?
No, he's American born. His father is British.
Oh, okay. Well, there's like a weird thing like that, too, a weird correlation to John Hopkins, because John Hopkins was English born and then grew up in America or something like that. But anyway, Joe Roberts, he's the American guy on the grid right now, and he's been part of a pretty shit team, but supposedly he's moving to a pretty good Moto2 team next year. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, so he started out, he did five races with Kalex.
Okay.
And those were just wild card. I think he did a wild card and then he was substituting the rest of the races. And he did okay. Like he picked up 6 points on a bike he'd pretty much never ridden before. And then he then got signed the next year with NTS and across an entire season got one less point than he did in his substitute races. Next year, he's getting signed with AGR.
Okay.
Which is supposedly a better team. And again, he's also got a super sport championship in AMA.
Right.
So like he's no pushover. But I think he's a young rider who hasn't quite met the right team yet and been able to put a season together.
Right. And let's hope he does.
But now we'll see how it goes, because he's getting put with a fairly decent team, and it's happening at a time when the whole class is switching up engines and bikes.
Right.
So it's now reset for everybody. So all these Spanish and Italian riders who have grown up in CEV with all of the standardized stuff and lived and breathed all these tracks, now it's all getting reset, and he's got a good team. So, I don't. Maybe he'll totally flop. Maybe he'll pull something amazing out, and we'll see.
Right. So I mentioned all those other riders before, just to kind of give you an idea of, like, you know, this kind of sort of 80s, 90s era leading even into early 2000s of Americans coming in and winning. Well, all of a sudden the bottom drops out there on the timeline. And now in the GP class, there's no one. And in fact, there's no one even in Moto 3. There's just Joe Roberts in Moto 2. Well, the only reason we even have Joe Roberts in Moto 2 is because the pipeline was for American riders coming into the premier class was just cut off, essentially, because of the way AMA racing works.
Well, there's one group you can blame in particular.
There is what
the
we got to get
to. The Daytona Motor Group.
Right. So we need to circle back to Wayne Rainey and what a big deal this guy is. And why, hopefully, in the next few coming years, we will see some more American riders returning, not returning, but new American riders in world racing, world motorcycle racing, because of Wayne Rainey. So go into a couple of the details on that, Swiggy.
So basically, at some point, the Daytona Motor Group kind of got the rights to sanction motorcycle road racing with the AMA in America.
Right.
And totally mismanaged it and drove it into the ground. Like the last few years of AMA pro racing were basically just dead. But then along comes Wayne Rainey and basically forms a partnership with FIM North America and with a couple other groups. And they then get the Daytona Motor Group to cede all of the rights to that to them and started Moto America in 2015.
Right. It's important there to say FIM North America, because FIM, it's French and it's like Fédération Internationale Motorcycle or whatever. It's a French, it is the governing body for motorcycle racing worldwide. So Wayne Rainey has taken AMA Superbike and Supersport racing and then gotten it sanctioned by an international racing body as well. And this is where it all comes across with the Moto America rebranding of everything. And so it has reopened the pipeline for Americans racing internationally. This is a big deal. Now, we haven't seen anyone jump over besides Joe Roberts yet.
Well, it takes a few years to get people into the pipeline.
Right. So here's the call to action. We've said it before on the show. Moto America is free to watch on YouTube. All the races, the coverage, the commentary, all of it. You just go to YouTube and just put in Moto America. They've got their channel and everything. You can watch whole seasons of it, just binge it, whatever you want to do. And it's good racing. But you're not just watching, like, some sort of backyard little just thrown together thing. This is a these are races sanctioned by the international sanctioning body for this stuff. These are races that matter on a large scale. So it's important to watch this stuff to support it, because then we will get the talent back into MotoGP. And then there you go. And then races like Austin will become that much bigger. Maybe we'll get two races in the United States again, like when we said Laguna Seca and Indianapolis. That was badass. You know, if you're into racing and motorcycles and you're not watching AMA, what are you doing with your life? Because it's great. It's really great. So this whole story kind of like starts and almost ends with Wayne Rainey right now. He's such an important player in this whole thing. So besides being a three-time winning MotoGP champion, essentially, he is this sort of like American motorcycle racing Moses, almost. Well, really, you know, like, and he's just a really nice, approachable guy too. I met him, like I said, at the AIM Expo very briefly, and he almost seemed like kind of surprised that I wanted to talk to him. I don't know why. We hadn't really like fired up the mics and started doing all of our interviews yet. In fact, I think we like went to one of our first interviews like right after we were talking to him. I should have just pegged him down and had him like commit to doing the show with us or something or whatever. But I mean, he's not just in the AMA like Hall of Fame. They like created this special like higher echelon of status within the AMA. And he was the first one inducted as an AMA legend, right? Like, right. That's what a big deal this guy is. And I'm sure if you just, you know, met Valentino Rossi tomorrow and, you know, just mentioned the name Wayne Rainey, I'm sure his eyes would light up like, oh, that guy's a big fucking deal, you know? So the whole point of this is, now we're doing like a few like calls to action in this episode, like, you know, send us those reviews, everybody, but also watch Moto America. What are you doing with your life if you're not? It's the winter. What else are you doing? It's free. And it will, you know, if enough of you guys do this, it will lead to some sort of, do I pretend that the entirety of our audience, our listening audience watching AMA Moto America is going to make the whole change? Of course not. But you might really get into it and then get your friends into it or something. Who knows? But it's free. Like FIM sanctioned motorcycle racing in America. And these races happen all over the country too. You can go and see one. It's not expensive. So there you go. I guess I kind of want to say as well on this that do y'all remember when America was number one in everything? Right? there was this great moment from like, you know, like the mid 80s to like the late 90s where it didn't matter what it was. It was like, oh yeah, like America's number one, you know? Like, it seems that the United States really only cares about that when like the Summer Olympics pop up every 4 years. They're like, okay, yeah, we really need to put forth an effort to make sure we get the most gold medals. But it kind of used to be the U.S. kind of like was number one in everything. And it wasn't number one in everything, but the perception was like, yeah, USA, we're number fucking one, bubs. And that's really disappeared a lot. And there was a time when USA was number one in motorcycle racing. I mean, how many of these years from in the 80s did we mention Americans winning the championship? I mean, like all of it from like 83 to like 1990, essentially. Americans just dominating, kicking ass left and fucking right. Don't you want to see a return to that? I do. You know, we have a very international background, so it doesn't really emotionally upset me if a Spaniard or an Italian or a Japanese guy or whoever wins it, you know, but it's been long enough. I really want to see an American come in and shake it up and just kick fucking ass. How great would it be for some American no-name on the international scene like Joe Roberts or whatever to just show up, get a factory ride, and just stomp all over Mark Marquez's dick? Oh, my God. That would be the greatest thing that could happen for the sports. I mean, because – yeah, it'd be nice to see like Lorenzo or someone or Dovizioso or whoever beat Marquez next year. Sure. That would be sort of satisfying. You know, we're all kind of in an anyone but Marquez frame of mind there. But wouldn't it be amazing, like, you know, even if Marquez wins like, you know, 11 championships and he's on top of his game, he eclipses Rossi for all time wins and championships and all of that stuff, and then just out of nowhere comes some American just good old boy and just fucking slaps his cock, leaving a big old print on his forehead. Just, oh, that would be so satisfying. Oh, oh, that would be the greatest thing ever, right? And, you know, let's say like Noradin or someone, you know, like gets, and, you know, it's like the first win ever from Malaysia in championship. That would be great too, but wouldn't it be especially great for it to be some just, you know, Copenhagen chewing good old American? Like, because MotoGP is like so Euro right now. It's so Euro, yeah. Which is kind of okay with me, but I understand like how that turns some people off. Who would be like the perfect, ridiculously ultra American sponsor for that race team? You know, like, I know they don't do like tobacco and stuff anymore, but like, you know, I'm trying to think of something just so American it couldn't be mistaken for anything else. Like,
it's so hard now because they can't do any like alcohol sponsors either.
I know, like a Bud Light Yamaha would be the most amazing thing ever. But,
you know, just bring back like just like Wonder Bread.
Yeah, full, there full we go. On Ricky Wonder Bobby, Bread. Wonder Bread. Wonder Bread. Or like Swiffer, right? Wonder Bread. Oh, yes. What if there was a fucking Wonder Bread Honda or something? It, like a satellite or
just like,
team.
Just like Colgate.
Colgate would be good too. What's the there's something like ellipse to me. No, I've got it. Skippy peanut butter. That's the one. We want like the Skippy peanut butter Suzuki just destroying HRC. That is my wet dream for motorcycle racing. I don't think we're going to do any better than Skippy peanut butter. All right. So, I guess to hear at the end, we're about ready to wrap things up. I'm just going to repeat one more time. Hey, everybody, leave ratings and reviews, not just for us, all the other smaller motorcycle podcasts as well. Hey, watch Torque so you're ready to sit along with us when we do this insane review that we're going to do. Like, trust us, we are compiling notes. We have a lot to say about it. And with that, I'm going to remind everyone to stay safe and stay tuned, and also send us an email at nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. And now we're ready to run the outro, I think, right?
Let's go.
All right. And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my